Well, as I mentioned a moment ago then, we're going to be considering this evening Ruth chapter 1, verses 6 to 18. So you may remember we began this series in Ruth 2 weeks ago. And in that first session then, we established that this book is not simply a homely little yarn about a girl who falls in love and then gets happily married. We said that the Bible is ultimately one story of God redeeming a people. And Ruth then, this book of Ruth, is inevitably a part of that one great story. And specifically then, this book is about God providing a king for his people. So the book immediately before this one, the book of Judges, demonstrated that God's people need a king. Remember, you have that refrain toward the end of Judges a couple of times, that Israel had no king. And we said last time then that that's not just a comment that's applicable only to the time of the Judges, but rather it's making a broader point that if this whole project of God having a people of sinners in this world is going to work, then that people needs a king. And what we have then in the book of Ruth is God providing a king for his people. In some ways, the most important word in the whole book is the very last word, and that word is David's. He is the king that God is providing for his people, although of course he is not the final king. The true king God is providing for his people is the Lord Jesus Christ, but David, I guess, gives us about the clearest glimpse of him that we have in the whole of the Old Testament. So we established that last time, that this book is part of this one unfolding story of redemption, and specifically about God providing for his people a king. And we said too that when then in the Bible God raises up major figures within his redemptive program, there are usually complications in the way that he does it. He doesn't do it in the most straightforward way, and particularly he often does it then through a mother who cannot possibly have a child. And here then we have God raising up David, this major figure in this unfolding story of redemption. And in his case then, we don't know much about his mother, but in his case we have his great-great-grandmother, Naomi. And she then cannot possibly be the bearer of Israel's king. She cannot possibly be the channel that God is going to use to raise up this king for his people. Now, of course, at the start of the story, it doesn't appear that it's impossible, because Naomi, she has a husband and she has these two sons, and all seems very rosy. But then, of course, by the time you get to verse 5, that's all been changed. And here's Naomi, and she has no husband, and she has no sons. And she's then in the same category now as women like Sarah, and Manoah's wife, and Elizabeth, and Mary. She's one of these women who cannot possibly be the bearer of some major figure that God is going to send for his people. But you see, God is doing with Naomi what he was doing with those other women. And in those first 5 verses of the book, he's stripping her of husband and sons, so that she cannot naturally be the channel through which God will bring about this king, but so that he can do it. God can do it in his own inimitable way. Which raises the question then, as we move into tonight's passage then, well, how is God going to do this then with Sarah, Manoah's wife, Elizabeth, Mary? He did it through a miraculous conception, didn't he? Slightly different circumstances in the different cases. But it, with those women, who couldn't possibly have a child naturally, he did it through a miraculous conception. Is that what he's going to do with Naomi? Well, it's not, is it? There's no miraculous conception with Naomi. Instead then, how do we get from chapter 1, verse 5, to chapter 4, verse 17, where people are saying a son has been born to Naomi? How do we get from this barren woman in chapter 1, verse 5, who's been stripped of husband and sons, how do we get from there to chapter 4, verse 17, a son has been born to Naomi? Well, it's not through a miraculous conception. Instead, it's through Ruth. That's the answer, isn't it? It's through this daughter-in-law. Ruth is the way in which God is going to enable Naomi to have this child and so ultimately be the bearer of Israel's king. Now that may sound a bit lame compared to the other stories of Sarah and Elizabeth and Mary and so on, where there's a miraculous conception. To say that, well, God's going to do it just through Ruth, it might seem a bit lame by comparison, but of course it's not lame, is it? The process by which Ruth becomes the answer to Naomi's barrenness, it may not be miraculous in the technical sense of that term, but it is nonetheless an extraordinary piece of divine activity. I mean, Ruth has just been this name so far, hasn't she, in what we've considered of the book so far. The first five verses, Ruth is just this name, just this Moabite woman. How on earth is she going to be the crucial link? How is she going to be the way that Naomi can have her child, as it were? Well, as I say, it's an extraordinary story. So, at one level then, God works through a quite remarkable sequence of events, doesn't he? You can clearly see God at work in the sequence of events here. So in the very first verse of our passage this evening, verse 6, we read of God doing something. The Lord ending this famine that has been taking place in Judah. And so the end of the famine isn't described as a mere meteorological phenomenon. Rain falling again, just like that. But it's described in theological terms. God visiting his people. God does something there in verse 6. God causes the famine to end and harvest to be possible again in Judah. But then there's also the interesting factor of the timing involved here, because we're told there then in verse 1, aren't we, that Naomi heard in the fields of Moab. She heard that the Lord now had provided food in Judah. Now, have you ever wondered why Naomi set off from Moab with her two daughters-in-law and didn't try to urge them to go back until further down the line? Why didn't she have that conversation with them in Moab? Why didn't she tell them then to stay? I mean, it'd be much more convenient for Orpah, wouldn't it, if she hadn't had to go through all the goodbyes with her family before then kind of coming back a few days later. Why doesn't that conversation take place still in Moab? Well, presumably because there's some urgency here. Because they've heard there in Moab that the famine has ended in Judah, and now they've got to get up pretty quick and make sure they get back in time to be able to benefit from the end of the famine and from the harvest. They could miss it. They could be too late. That seems to be the implication. There's a sense of urgency here. Which means then that when we come to verse 22 and we read that they got back just at the right time, at the beginning of barley harvest. Again, you see God's hand in that, don't you? This is God just working things, arranging things, so that everything is falling into place. They arrive just at the right moment, at the beginning of the harvest. And then, of course, God's arrangement of all of this is most evident in when we come to chapter 2 and the way in which Ruth goes out to do some gleaning. And we're told, aren't we, that she just happened to go into the field of Boaz, who was related to Elimelech. She could have gone into any field in Bethlehem and she just happened to go into that field. And again, we see God's hand behind that. So God then is clearly at work at that level here. He's orchestrating this whole sequence of events in order to get Ruth to Judah, in order that Ruth can meet Boaz, and in order that Ruth can have the baby for her mother-in-law, Naomi. But I think we need to appreciate, and this is the real emphasis of our passage this evening, that there's more going on here than that. That here we have God at work, not just around Ruth, kind of orchestrating events and circumstances and situations to get her to where she needs to be. But we even see God at work in Ruth, not just around Ruth in the events, but even in Ruth. We see him doing something within the very makeup of this woman. And while then certainly there would be no baby born at the end of the book were it not for the kind of external events, God arranging this sequence of events, the harvest coming and them arriving on time and her meeting Boaz and all the rest of it, equally there would be no baby born at the end of the book were it not for God doing this thing inside of Ruth as well. And it's that then that we're going to focus on in the remainder of our time. And I want us to notice then kind of three aspects to this. Three areas within Ruth, if you like, or to do with Ruth's person, her makeup, her character, three areas where God is at work. First of all, in Ruth's instincts. Ruth's instincts. So, if you look at verse 8 then, at some point in the journey, they've set off from Moab, the three women. At some point in the journey, Naomi says to Ruth, "May the Lord deal kindly with you as you have dealt with the dead and with me." Now, I guess the most famous part of our passage this evening is verses 16 and 17, and we'll come to that properly a little bit later on. But just to suffice to say for now, that I take it verses 16 and 17 represent a genuine heart thing going on with Ruth. That they are an expression of genuine allegiance to Yahweh, to the God of Israel. I'm happy to use terms like regenerate and believer in connection with Ruth. I think that those two verses support such statements being made about this woman. However, having said that, what we have here in verse 8, this kindness that Naomi recognizes in Ruth and to which she testifies, this kindness that Ruth has shown toward her, that has nothing to do with the faith in Yahweh she expresses in verses 16 and 17. How do we know that? Well, because Orpah has shown the same kindness to Naomi as well, hasn't she? Naomi recognizes this kindness not only in Ruth, but in Orpah too. Now, Orpah, as far as we know, remained a pagan all her life. There's no evidence that Orpah ever came to faith in the God of Israel. And yet Orpah had shown this kindness too. So the kindness that we see in Ruth and in Orpah in verse 8, that has nothing to do, I'm saying, with faith in Yahweh. It's just a kindness that Ruth has shown to her mother-in-law, Naomi. But it's no ordinary kindness. I mean, the word that Naomi uses, it's the Hebrew word chesed, which is a very strong word, as some of you may know. It's not just a kind of polite, superficial kindness, a skin-deep thing. This is that unbreakable loyalty. This is covenant love. That's really what the word is getting at. It's the thing that characterizes Yahweh himself. He is everywhere in the Old Testament described as a God of steadfast love or loving kindness in the older versions. This Hebrew word chesed. And it's a godlike characteristic then, And yet here, it's been attributed to these pagan women, Orpah and Ruth. They, following the deaths of Elimelech and then Mahlon and Chilion, they had remarkably shown this godlike devotion to their mother-in-law, Naomi. Now, my point here is that they didn't really have any rational ground for doing so. They were Moabites. They worshipped the god Chemosh. Now, there was nothing in Moabite religion about chesed, about covenant love. In Moabite theology, Chemosh wasn't a god of covenant love any more than any of the pagan deities were. And nor did Chemosh encourage covenant love in his worshippers. There was nothing in their religion to encourage this. Rather, the opposite. It was like so many of the pagan cults. It was a self-centered sort of religion. And everything then about their theological beliefs, everything about their worldview would have encouraged these two women to be selfish and to utterly ignore Naomi and sever their ties with her as soon as their husbands were dead, to say, well, we're not going to bother with Naomi anymore. What use is she to us? We don't need her anymore. She's not going to provide us with husbands ever again. And she's an Israelite. She's a foreigner. Let's forget Naomi. Let's sever our ties with her for good. That's how they should have behaved toward Naomi if they had been acting consistently with their worldview, with their beliefs. That's what I'm saying. Yet instead they didn't. They just seem to have this unexplainable instinct to be kind, really kind, devoted to their mother-in-law, to Naomi, even though it went against every rational application of their worldview. And without that then, without that groundless, baseless loyalty in Ruth, she would never have become what she later becomes. She would never have become the bearer of Naomi's child at the end of the book. She would, as I say, have severed all ties with Naomi as soon as the funerals were over. And so it's crucial, this instinct within Ruth, it's crucial to the whole story. And why is it there then? Well, it's there because God has put it there, isn't it? And it's part of God's dealings with the human race that he does this often, doesn't he? It's part of what we often call God's common grace, that God does put in the hearts of human beings instincts to do good things and noble things, which actually their worldview gives them no reason to do. I remember hearing Tim Keller once say that there are two theological concepts that are crucial to assessing all human behavior, and they are common grace on the one hand and total depravity on the other hand. And so common grace then, it explains why non-Christians aren't as bad as their beliefs should make them. And total depravity explains why Christians aren't as good as their beliefs should make them. And here we have the first part of that with Ruth. That she was this pagan who had no reason to be kind to her mother-in-law according to her worldview. And yet, God ensures that she's not as bad as her beliefs should have made her. There's this instinct to be kind, to be noble. And we see that, don't we? We all know non-Christians in our families and in our workplaces who do lots of good things and say lots of good things and act with kindness and nobility and a sacrificial spirit often. And it's a great thing that that's so, isn't it? This world will be a dreadful place otherwise. It's part of God's kindness, his grace. And we see then God at work and saying, first of all, in Ruth's very instincts. And that is crucial to the story. So God at work in Ruth's instincts. But then secondly this evening, God at work in Ruth's shortcomings. God at work in Ruth's shortcomings. Now, you may remember I said 2 weeks ago that I'm reluctant to lay too many accusations at Elimelech's feet. So many sermons, many commentaries will really lay into this guy Elimelech, because he should never, we're told, have left Bethlehem in the first place. He should have just remained there. It was God's judgment that the famine fell. He should have remained there and been part of a movement of repentance, of national repentance, instead of just escaping conveniently to Moab. But I said that I'm reluctant, for various reasons, to go down that route. Now, though it's you're much less likely to hear it said by preachers and commentators, I think actually we're on safer ground laying a few accusations at Ruth's door here in our opening chapter of the book. You know, it's interesting, isn't it, that in verses 11 to 13, in Naomi's little speech there, three times she refers to these two women, Ruth and Orpah, not as her daughters-in-law, but as her daughters. Three times she describes them as her daughters, and similarly in the rest of the book, although Orpah, of course, disappears, Ruth is referred to by Naomi as her daughter. And clearly this is not just a nominal thing, there's a genuine mother-daughter relationship between these two women. So in chapter 2, verse 2, we have Ruth kind of asking Naomi's permission, don't we, to go and glean in the fields of Bethlehem, treating Naomi as her mother, as an authority figure in her life, from whom she must get permission before going and doing this. And then it's even more striking in chapter 3, verses 1 to 4, where we have Naomi then kind of basically making marital arrangements for Ruth and telling her to go and lie next to Boaz and all the rest of it. And in the ancient Near East then, mothers would make marital arrangements for their daughters. I think that's actually why in chapter 1, verse 8, we have the interesting phrase, Naomi saying to Orpah and Ruth, go each of you to your mother's house. You'd expect father's house in a kind of patriarchal society. But as I say, the mother was the one who made marital arrangements for her daughter. And so here, really, I think Naomi is saying, go back and allow your mothers to make new marital arrangements for you, now that your husbands have died. But my point is that in chapter 3, verses 1 to 4, we have Naomi now performing that role with regard to Ruth, and acting then as her mother. And that being so then, chapter 3, verse 5 is appropriate and proper, isn't it? We have Naomi telling Ruth what to do, and then we have Ruth replying in verse 5, all that you say I will do. I mean, that's fifth commandment stuff. This Naomi is now effectively Ruth's mother, I'm saying. And there we have then Ruth responding as an obedient and compliant daughter. But it's quite a contrast what we have in our passage here, isn't it? There's no obedience and compliance here. I mean, I think often we picture Ruth as this very demure and gentle person. She's pretty feisty in our passage, isn't she? Naomi is telling her, go back. And Ruth basically says, don't you tell me what to do. Verse 16, don't urge me to leave you. And then we can say, well, Naomi here has just been too selfless, and she's in fact probably more than that, being self-pitying, and she probably kind of, in a perverse sort of way, wants Ruth to go so that she'll have one last kind of deprivation to moan about and complain to God about. So Ruth is right to overrule that and to insist that she does stay with Naomi. We can go down that route, but at the end of the day, here we have a mother who is telling her daughter how to arrange the rest of her life. And the daughters say, no, I'm not going to listen to you. And so in a sense, Orpah is the obedient and compliant one who listens and goes back. Ruth shows this more rebellious spirit. And yet, again, God, of course, is at work in this. Because again, this is crucial to the whole story. If Ruth was obedient, she'd have gone back, and she would have never got to chapter 4, verse 17, and Naomi being given a child through Ruth. And so God is at work, even not just through Ruth's instincts, as was the case earlier on there, but even in Ruth's shortcomings, her feistiness, her lack of compliance here. Now, we need to be careful, don't we, whenever we talk like this, we need to insist that God is not at work in Ruth's shortcomings in such a way that God's own perfect sinlessness is compromised. God is not here complicit in the guilt of Ruth's disobedience. Nor is God at work in Ruth's shortcomings in such a way that Ruth couldn't help herself. We can always help ourselves. We always choose, don't we, to act wrongly. We're never somehow forced to act wrongly. Nor is God at work in Ruth's shortcomings in such a way that Ruth didn't subsequently need to repent. But God was at work in Ruth's shortcomings nonetheless. And aren't we all thankful that God is at work in our shortcomings, in our failures, in our flaws, in our deficiencies? Yes, those shortcomings are regrettable. Yes, those shortcomings are hell deserving. But yes, too, our shortcomings are somehow, and we can't fully understand this, but they are somehow part of God's infinitely perfect, infinitely wise activity in this world. Somehow our shortcomings are caught up into what God is doing. Our failures are caught up in what God is doing. And that's what we see with Ruth here. So God is at work in Ruth's instincts, and he's at work in Ruth's shortcomings. But then thirdly and finally, we also see God at work in Ruth's faith. God at work in Ruth's faith. So if Naomi then is going to have this child, if she's going to be the bearer of a child, and ultimately then the channel of God's provision of a king for his people, we're saying that Ruth has to get to Judah, and she has to marry Boaz and all the rest of it. And so we're saying then that, start with, it was just this unexplainable instinct of kindness to Naomi that carried her on that journey. And then after that, it was her shortcomings, her refusal to listen to her mother, that carried her further on that journey. But ultimately, what really settles the matter, what really ensures beyond any doubt that Ruth is going to go to Judah and she's not going to retrace her steps to Moab, is her faith in Yahweh, her faith in Israel's covenant gods. At some point, faith in Yahweh has chased away and replaced Ruth's native faith in Chemosh. And that's expressed then powerfully in verses 16 and 17. Now, some will say otherwise. Some will say that here in verses 16 and 17, still all we have basically is Ruth expressing her kindness, her devotion to Naomi. And still then she's just being loyal to Naomi. And she's basically saying to Naomi, look, I'm determined, I'm not going to leave you, I'm going to come and I'm going to live with you and I'm going to be part of your people. And inevitably, if I'm going to be part of your people, that will involve me exchanging my old religious practices, and now I'll have to kind of worship your God a bit as well, and I can't worship Chemosh if I'm coming to live in Israel. And it's more like that. That's how some people read it. That really this is her being loyal to Naomi and kind of having to worship Yahweh a bit was just a kind of byproduct of moving to Israel. But I don't think that is the case at all. And I guess the same people who would say that would say that we're just being kind of anachronistic when we talk about Ruth having a conversion experience. We're applying a New Testament concept of the new birth to an Old Testament situation. But let me just, as we close, respond to that in a few different ways. First of all, at that general level, there's nothing wrong, is there, with applying the New Testament concept of the new birth to an Old Testament situation. At the end of the day, if everybody in the Old Testament was born dead in trespasses and sins, and surely we would all have to agree on that, and if there were in the Old Testament any people who exercised true faith, and on the basis of Hebrews 11 and many other passages would have to conclude that, then those people who were exercising true faith in the Old Testament must have had a new birth experience, mustn't they? They must somehow have got from being dead in trespasses and sins to exercising faith. They must have had a conversion experience. The terminology may not have existed in the Old Testament, but the concept obviously did. The reality obviously did. But then, secondly and more specifically, it's clear from the structure of Ruth's speech there that devotion to Naomi is not the primary thing. Yes, she is devoted to Naomi, but that's not the primary thing. The speech here doesn't come across in the way it's set out, probably in our versions, but there's a kind of sandwich structure to it, and just like in an edible sandwich, it's the middle bit that's the best bit, that's the important bit. And so notice then that in verse 16, she says, where you will go, I will go, and where you lodge, I will lodge. And then notice in verse 17, she says, where you die, I will die, and there will I be buried. Now those are clearly quite similar phrases, aren't they? There's a similar phraseology in both of them. Where you go, I will go. Where you die, I will die. And the kind of those two phrases kind of bring together life and death, don't they? So in life, I will go where you go. In death, I will die where you die. So they're kind of the bread layers, if you like, on the outside. Well, what's in the middle then? What's between them? Well, the second half of verse 16. Your people shall be my people and your God my God. So I think just that simple point, the structure there, that makes it evident. The primary thing, the focal thing, isn't her devotion to being with, her commitment to being with Naomi. The middle bit is actually her confession of Yahweh as her God and therefore Yahweh's people as her people. Then, thirdly, we can say this, that if Ruth is just being kind to Naomi, then it's a bit unnecessary, isn't it, to say that where you die, I will die, and I'll be buried where you're buried. Because she could have just moved to Israel for the rest of Naomi's lifetime. And then as soon as Naomi died, she could have gone back to Moab. If it was just Naomi she's bothered about, there's no need to commit herself to being in Israel the rest of her days and being buried in Israel. Again, then, that speaks against that idea. Or then, fourthly, the book's own definitive commentary on Ruth's actions comes to us, doesn't it, through the words of Boaz in chapter 2. And in chapter 2, verse 12, this is how he interprets what Ruth has done. He says there that, at the end of the verse, the God of Israel, under whose wings you have come to take refuge. What was Ruth doing when she came to Israel? Coming to look after Naomi primarily? No, coming to take refuge under the wings of Yahweh. And that's a recurring picture in the Old Testament. We sang it in Psalm 36 earlier on. And there, you remember, it was part of a package of intimacy with Jehovah. The psalmist not only taking shelter under God's wings, but also enjoying a feast with Yahweh. Yahweh kind of treating him to a feast. It's all the language of intimacy, intimate relationship. And Boaz is saying that's what happened to Ruth. She came into an intimate relationship with Yahweh. Well, then, fifthly, I said last time that embedded within this whole book, there are lots of links back to the patriarchal narratives. The narratives of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. And I think here then, Ruth's journey from Moab to Israel, it's reminiscent of Abraham's journey from Ur, where he began, to Canaan. And that's not just, I'm not saying that on a whim. We have a telling verbal connection. Again, in chapter 2, verse 11, Boaz says that you left your father and mother and your native land and came to a people that you did not know before. Now, that's an interesting phrase, your native land. In Genesis 24, verse 7, Abraham is about to send his servant off to find a wife for Isaac. And he says to his servant, he says that I left my father's household, and I left the land of my kindred. And that's exactly the same Hebrew phrase as here, native land. It's translated there in Genesis 24, the land of my kindred. Abraham had left the land of his kindred. And here Boaz is saying Ruth had left the land of her kindred in order to come to Israel. Now, why did Abraham do that? Well, there are kind of two biblical perspectives on that, aren't there? The perspective in Genesis is that he did it out of obedience to God's call. God told him to leave, and so he left. Obedience is the major motif in Genesis. Come to Hebrews 11, of course, and faith is what's emphasized. That Abraham went on that journey because of faith. And faith, then, not simply that God was going to give him an inheritance in Canaan, but beyond something bigger than that. That God was going to give him a heavenly country. That's what Hebrews 11 says. Abraham believed that God was going to give him a city with foundations, whose builder and architect is God. That God was going to give him a heavenly inheritance. And somehow Canaan was just a little picture, a little pledge, a little down payment of something much bigger in the future that God was going to give him. And I think then, on the basis of these verbal connections, we can infer that it was the same with Ruth. That she is driven on this journey by faith. And again then, faith not simply that God is going to give her a new home in Israel, but that God was going to give her a greater new home, a heavenly country. And somehow Israel was just a little picture and pledge of that. So again, that's probably why she emphasizes burial. It's interesting with the patriarchs, with Jacob and Joseph, there's this great concern, isn't there, that they should be buried in Canaan, in the promised land, even though they die elsewhere, that they should be buried in Canaan. I don't think it's just sentimentalism. They perhaps couldn't have put it in the language of types and so on, but I think it was because they appreciated God was going to give them a heavenly country, and somehow Canaan was a little picture and a little type, a little down payment, a pledge of that. And so they wanted to be buried there. And here's Ruth, she wants to be buried, definitely, she's saying, I want to be buried in Israel. She realizes that it has some significance, Israel, beyond death itself. And in the distant future. And so she's driven by faith, and very driven by faith. She rearranges her whole life, doesn't she, on the basis then of this faith in this future heavenly country. And as we close then, just two quick points to make. First of all, does Ruth's experience resonate with us tonight? Are we like Ruth, those who have come to take refuge in Jehovah? Indeed, those who have come to take refuge in Jehovah Jesus, in the one who said to the city of Jerusalem, like a hen who gathers her chicks under her wings, how often I have longed to gather you. Have we taken refuge under Jesus' wings? Is that what it means for us to be a Christian? Or is it just a name? Is it just a box we tick on the census form, I'm a Christian? Is it just a creed we can reel off? Or is it actually that we've taken refuge? We've come into an intimate relationship with Jesus Christ. Is our whole life being shaped by a faith in a future beyond death, beyond history? A heavenly country. Does Ruth's experience here resonate with us? But then, secondly, just to come back to where we started, and the main point here, that God then is making sure that Naomi is going to be the channel of him providing a king. And how's barren Naomi going to be that channel? Through Ruth. How's that going to happen? Well, yes, through a whole series of external events. But more than that, God, even working in Ruth, God, in order to fulfill his purposes, he can even get into this woman's life and do something there. It's a bit like what we see in Acts, isn't it? And you remember how then in those early chapters you have this great threat to the spread of the gospel, this great threat to the church itself, Saul of Tarsus. And he looks like he's going to just stop the gospel from advancing at all. He's going to wipe the whole movement out. But God deals with that. And how does he deal with it? Through killing Saul? Through just annihilating him? Through blasting him off the scene? He could have done that. But he did something even more amazing, kind of reached into Saul's life and changed him within. And that's the God we have, a God who is never stuck when it comes to fulfilling his purposes. If he has to, he can even reach into someone's life and change their very faith, their very basic allegiance. God will do everything that he is eternally purposed to do, because an infinite array of means are at his disposal. He can even work, not only in events, but on the inside of people. He can work in the hearts and souls of men and women. What a God we have. Amen.